Well, good afternoon, everyone. If I may have your attention for just a few moments. My name, for those of you who have not met me, is Gregory Cody, and I am with McCarter and English here in Boston. And myself and Dan Kelly run the Boston chapter of the Federalist Society. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the organization, the Federalist Society is an organization committed to creating awareness and discussion of legal issues, primarily from a constitutional perspective. And we accomplish that goal by holding events such as this, where we feature speakers of prominence to discuss timely and timeless legal issues. We also sponsor a number of debates and panel discussions on topics throughout the year as well. Most notably, our most notable event is the Shakespeare in the Law series, and it's my understanding that we're putting together another event this year, I believe sixth or seventh in a row now, and that will take place sometime, I believe, in May. So please keep your eyes open for the announcement for that event. Today's event is somewhat of a first for us in that we are collaborating with a number of the law schools throughout the New England region, and we're very, very pleased for that because it's something that we've wanted to do for quite a while. And I just want to take a moment and recognize each of those law students that are here. We have representatives from Suffolk University Law School here in Boston, Boston University Law School, Northeastern University Law School, New England School of Law, the University of Maine and Vermont Law School. So we have representatives from throughout New England, and some of them came a great distance to attend. So thank you all very much, and we appreciate your involvement. Today's speaker is Paul Clement, the United States Solicitor General. Paul Clement is the 43rd Solicitor General of the United States. He was nominated by President George W. Bush on March 14, 2005, confirmed by the United States Senate on June 8, 2005, and took the oath of office on June 13, 2005. Mr. Clement is a native of Cedarburg, Wisconsin, and a graduate of the Cedarburg Public Schools. He received his bachelor's degree summa cum laude from the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and a master's degree in economics from Cambridge University. He graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School, where he was the Supreme Court editor of the Harvard Law Review. Following graduation, Mr. Clement clerked for Judge Lawrence Silberman of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and for Associate Justice Antonin Scalia of the United States Supreme Court, whom I understand had a celebration last night for, I believe it's 20th anniversary on the Supreme Court. And that was actually something that was honored during the Lawyers Convention for the Federalist Society a couple of weeks ago for those of you that were there. After his clerkships, Mr. Clement worked as an associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis. Mr. Clement went on to serve as chief counsel of the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution, Federalism, and Property Rights. Afterwards, he was a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of King & Spalding, where he headed the firm's appellate practice. Mr. Clement also served from 1998 to 2004 as an adjunct professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, where he taught a seminar on the separation of powers. Mr. Clement joined the Department of Justice in February of 2001. Before his confirmation as Solicitor General, he served as acting Solicitor General for nearly a year and as Principal Deputy Solicitor General. He has argued over 35 cases before the United States Supreme Court, including McConnell v. FEC, Tennessee v. Lane, Rumsfeld v. Padilla, United States v. Booker, and Gonzalez v. Raich. He also argued many of the key cases in the lower courts involving challenges to the president's conduct of the war on terrorism. Please welcome our esteemed guest, the Solicitor General, Paul Clement.
Well, thank you, Greg, for that very kind introduction, and thank all of you for coming, both for signing up and deciding on this inordinately beautiful day to show up and spend an hour indoors. I appreciate it. What I wanted to do this afternoon is spend just a couple of minutes talking about what I will label sort of a preview of the Supreme Court term and then I hope to leave a couple of minutes for questions. Now, you could reasonably ask, well, isn't it a little late in the term to be doing a preview, since the court has already had two sittings and is halfway through its third sitting of the year. The reason I don't think it's too late, though, is because the Supreme Court at this point has handed down all of one opinion. So most of the substance of what the court will decide is still to be determined. And it's also true that although the court has at this point set about a little over two-thirds of the cases for argument this term, there's still about a third, a little less than a third, of the court's docket where the court can add cases that will still be heard and decided before the end of June this year. And at the very end of my talk, I'll mention at least one or two cases that I think are of interest that the court is, that are not yet on the court's docket, but may well be on the court's docket and therefore all of our radar screens before the end of the year. Let me start with talking about a couple of cases, though, that I think that the court has already heard argument in one set of cases and is going to hear argument next week in the other set of cases that I think are certainly what anybody would label as important and interesting cases. The first set of cases I'll talk about are the cases involving the constitutionality of the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act. The court heard argument with respect to two cases challenging the constitutionality of the Federal Partial Birth Act at the beginning of the month, at the beginning of November. And, of course, in these cases, the Supreme Court's previous decision involving a state statute also banning partial birth abortion, the Stenberg against Carhart case, figures very prominently in the debate in these cases. As you may recall, the Stenberg case was decided 5-4 with the court striking down the Nebraska statute as unconstitutional. The Congress, in responding to the Stenberg case, while the Stenberg case was pending, Congress had already introduced and, in fact, passed a partial birth abortion ban on the federal level, but President Clinton at that point had vetoed the ban. When the Stenberg decision came down, Congress tried to revise the statute. In the Stenberg decision, the court identified two problems with the Nebraska statute. First, that it lacked a health exception, and second, that the definition of partial birth abortion didn't adequately distinguish what the legislature intended to go after, which was one procedure, as opposed to being capable of actually covering all second trimester abortions. So those were the two defects identified in Stenberg. Congress went in to try to address both of those defects, but they did it in different ways. With respect to the definitional issue, they really did change the definition in the statute and made quite a different statutory text in terms of the federal law versus the state law. With respect to the health exception, though, what the Congress really did is to take the court's premise that there was a need for a health exception straight on and made findings, congressional findings, that Congress pointed out should be entitled to deference, made findings that a health exception was not necessary. So that's the federal statute that was enacted. That's the federal statute that goes up to the Supreme Court. It goes up after three different circuit courts have struck down the federal statute as basically being insufficiently distinguishable from the prior Stenberg case. Now, the government, obviously, federal government, is before the court, was before the court, defending the constitutionality of a federal act. I mean, that's, well, typically the executive branch will, as long as there's a good faith argument to be made in defense of a statute, and as long as the statute doesn't implicate negatively executive branch authority, the Justice Department will defend an act of Congress. So, of course, we're up there defending the act of Congress. We make essentially two arguments. One, that this case, because of the findings, because of the new definition, is distinguishable from the Stenberg case. And second, and alternatively, if the court feels that this case is not distinguishable, that the only way to uphold the federal act is to overrule the Stenberg case, we then argue that the court should, in fact, overrule the Stenberg case. And, of course, that means that this case presents, at least in part, or has the potential to present a very interesting insight into how the new Roberts Court will address issues of stare decisis, because that's obviously an issue that figured very prominently in both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito's confirmation hearings. And here is a case very early in their time together, first full term, both Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, that will at least potentially present a important issue of stare decisis. And, of course, even if the court doesn't confront issues of stare decisis and whether to overrule Stenberg directly, even that may provide some insights into how the court will proceed in this area. If the court goes out of its way to distinguish the prior precedents, that alone may tell us that the court is more likely to try to find ways to not directly confront overruling its precedents. A similar, though slightly less dramatic, involvement of prior precedent is in the second set of cases I want to mention. These are the cases involving the use of race in school assignment and student assignment in K through 12 programs. And this is an issue that I think is an important one in the court's docket. Have to confess it's very much on my own mind since I'll be arguing these cases as supporting the United States as amicus next Monday. So this is, like I said, something that I'm sort of living with and eating with right now, and so it's very much on my mind. I'll mention that the two cases that the court is hearing here have a lot of similarities, a few differences. One of the cases comes out of Louisville in the Jefferson County School District. The other case comes out of Seattle. Both cases involve the express use of race to assign students to one school rather than another. And both programs also have the feature that the school districts have recognized that among the public schools that there are virtues in having student choice. So this is not a plan that sort of definitively assigns students just to neighborhood schools. This is a plan that gives them a fair degree of flexibility to choose their school. And in the Seattle case, for example, they basically have open enrollment for the 10 high schools in Seattle. So it's just there aren't really school district sublines or high school lines. You can apply to any school in the district. And that's why I think the use of race becomes more pronounced, if you will, because the way that these programs work, you can basically go to school any school you want, unless under certain circumstances, if one student of one race will change the balance of the school in a way that the city deems improper, then that student who could otherwise go to the school and could go to the school if they had a different race is denied the opportunity to go to the school of choice because of their race. One thing that's interesting about the Seattle plan is that the Seattle plan is issued by the District of Seattle, which has never operated under a court-ordered decree. There's never been a prior finding of de jure segregation in Seattle. And that's one important difference, I think, between the Seattle case and the Louisville case, because in the Louisville case, the school district operated under a court-ordered decree based on a court finding of de jure discrimination, of having a dual school system. And then about 5 years ago, there was a finding of unitary status and that there was no longer a reason to have court involvement or court-ordered remedies. And essentially what the school district has done is voluntarily continue the same basic plans that they'd used pursuant to the court order. And again, you have situations here where, especially when you combine an element of student choice, you get in a situation where the plaintiff in the Louisville case, for example, wanted to transfer from one elementary school to another, even though there were open seats at the school that the student was interested in going to. That student couldn't transfer because a white student leaving the one elementary school and going to the other would upset the racial balances at the two school. An African-American school student at the very same school would have been encouraged, in fact, to transfer to one of those open seats because it would have had an ameliorative effect on the racial balance in the two schools. On the way up to Boston yesterday, I actually read the First Circuit's opinion involving the Lynn School District. So this is a case where, even though the Lynn case is not one of the two cases, it's directly before the court. This is obviously an issue that is not limited to any one part of the country, and the First Circuit has dealt with itself. And I note that there are some differences between the Lynn program and these two programs as well, but they all share a lot of common features. I think in these cases, of course, the prior precedents of the court that will loom very large are the cases from a couple of terms ago involving the use of race at the University of Michigan at both the law school and the undergraduate program, the Grutter and Gratz cases. As you'll recall, the court upheld the use of race in the law school setting, struck it down in the undergraduate setting in the Gratz case. In the Grutter case, they basically said that the law school's application process, admissions process, involved a holistic review of the students such that race did not predominate. On the other hand, the undergraduate program was really kind of, giving every student of a favored race a 20-point bonus in the application process. The court found that to be too mechanical in the use of race, not enough individualized consideration. So one thing the court could do in deciding these cases is simply say, well, there's a line between Grutter and Gratz, and decide whether this is more like Grutter or more like Gratz. Another thing the court could do, of course, is consider the continuing validity of the Grutter and Gratz opinions. It's also, of course, possible that the court could decide these cases on very narrow grounds and really focus on the very particulars of the way that the two programs work. But anyway, they decided, I think, again, you'll find some interesting insights about how the new court is going to approach issues of stare decisis. The court also has before it two interesting environmental cases. One has, again, something of a local flavor. When I was flying back yesterday, a couple of lawyers who were helping out the state's effort in the greenhouse gases case were involved. We're on the same plane flight, and we talked about how the argument went, because the argument in this case was just yesterday. And I tend to think about this case as the so-called greenhouse gases case. I say that not really to denigrate the science and the argument about climatic change. In fact, today would be a hard day to do it. I spent 3 years at law school here in the area, and I just don't remember it being sunny and in the 60s the day before December. So something's changed. But whatever it is, even before you get to the issues of science, the reason I say it's not maybe properly understood as a greenhouse gases case is the court really has a couple of issues to decide before they even get to some of the issues about the science in this area. The first question in the case that looms large and certainly occupied about half of the oral argument yesterday was the question of whether or not the plaintiffs have standing in this case. And it is, whether they ultimately have standing or not, you definitely have a relatively unusual posture of this case where you have a state suing the federal government in order to complain that the federal government has not regulated something. It was kind of an interesting contrast because the second case of the day was a case involving preemption and banking regulation, and you had the state of Michigan in court in, I think, a more usual posture of complaining that the federal government was regulating things that properly belonged to the state of Michigan to regulate, and so there was kind of role reversal between the two cases, for better or for worse. You also have the dynamic that global warming issues tend to affect everyone to some degree, but no one person to any great degree. And I think one of the things that the court was struggling with was the idea that, depending on how you look at the case, either everyone would have standing or no one would have standing. And usually in an Article III case or controversy, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. So I think the standing issue definitely looms large in the case. But even if they get past the standing issue, then the next issue is whether or not the EPA even has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases or climactic change. And that presents an issue very similar to one that the court confronted a couple of terms ago in the context of tobacco regulation, the Brown and Williamson case. Because you have a situation where, on the one hand, something seems like it's within the regulatory structure. In that case, it seemed like nicotine could be regulated as a drug by the FDA. But there are enough indications in the other areas of the law that Congress really didn't expect that big-ticket issue to be regulated in the context of an existing regulatory regime. I mean, Justice Scalia, writing the opinion in the Brown and Williamson case, put it as only he could put it, that Congress doesn't usually hide elephants in mouse holes. And the point he was making is when you have a big issue like tobacco regulation or climactic change, you wouldn't necessarily think that the authorization to deal with that would be in the details of a regulatory regime. You might think that Congress, if it was going to give that authority, would give it more frontally in a regime that dealt with that particular sensitive subject. If you get past those two issues, then you get to the issue of whether or not the EPA, once you find that it had the authority to regulate climactic change, erred in not exercising that authority in this particular case. So it's a case that really, if you look at the D.C. Circuit opinions in this case, you had three judges who addressed different issues among themselves, and there really wasn't one clean-ish opinion for the court. One of the cases I argued last term involved the Clean Water Act, where the court split 4-1-4 as to the jurisdiction of the Corps of Army Engineers and the EPA over regulating tributaries of navigable waters. Richard Lazarus, who's a law professor at Georgetown, who's a well-known environmental scholar, said that as a result of that case, the Rapanos case, environmental law had its baki, which is to say that you had a plurality opinion that governed the law and was difficult to figure out what the real holding of the court is. Given all the different issues in the greenhouse gases case, it's certainly possible that you could replicate that this term, where you would have five votes for a disposition, but some on standing, some on the merits. And so this is a case, as complicated as it is, as important as it is, may not end up clarifying the law that much in the end. The other environmental case is almost too complicated to explain. It's the Duke Energy case, which involves the circumstances in which, when changing a existing power plant, a power company needs to get a permit from the EPA. There are really two questions as the case comes to the court. One question is simply what court the dispute should have taken place in. In this particular case, the Fourth Circuit struck down the position of the EPA and the environmental plaintiffs and sided with the power company. But there's a real live question as to whether or not the Fourth Circuit had any business doing that, or whether, in fact, the case should have gone forward in the D.C. Circuit, where you typically have challenges to rules. And that's an issue that the court, when it was discussing the case last sitting, did spend some time talking about. If you get past that question and the court holds that it was in the right court, then really the question, at least as the EPA, my client, sees it, is really one of regulatory flexibility. Because what's happened in these cases is that the EPA, for two different permitting programs, has decided that the trigger for what's a sufficient change to require a new permit is going to be different in the two programs, even though the statutory terms of change and modification are the same in the two programs. And the position of the government is effectively, look, if a term is ambiguous enough that the government gets Chevron deference, so we can interpret it one way or another as long as it's reasonable, there's no requirement just because the word appears twice in a statute in different contexts for us to interpret it reasonably and the same way in both places. As long as the construction is reasonable in each place, doesn't matter whether we have the same construction of the term in both places. In that sense, I think it does present a broader and interesting question of the degree to which you have regulatory flexibility for the regulators, or whether once they decide that a term means something under Chevron, they're basically locked into that position for all purposes. Let me talk for a couple of minutes about some cases on the court's docket that I think I would loosely describe as being on the business docket of the court. One big case that the court's already heard argument in involved the constitutionality of punitive damages awards, and this is the Philip Morris case against Williams, involved a almost $80 million punitive damages award. And this case, as you may know, the court has recently said that there are due process limits on punitive damages awards. They announced those principles in two cases, the BMW against Gore, and the State Farm case. And this case presents, I think, an interesting application of those cases. The court in those cases said there are a couple of factors that go into determining whether a punitive damages award is too large. One of the factors is the ratio of compensatory damages, punitive damages to compensatory damages. The court basically suggested, especially in State Farm, that if punitive damages are more than 10 times the amount of compensatory damages, that raises some real red flags. Another factor, of course, is the reprehensibility of the underlying conduct that's being remedied by the punitive damages. And I think one way to think about the Philip Morris case is what do you do when two of the prongs of the B&W test point in different directions? Because as to the ratio, which, of course, is the easiest to grab because it's definitive. I mean, the ratio here is, depending on whether you look at the original amount of compensatory damages or the remitted amount of compensatory damages, it's something like 80 to 1 or over 100 to 1 in terms of the ratio. And applying the ratio analysis, that would seem to be out of bounds. But, of course, there were findings by the State Supreme Court in this case and the trial court that the conduct involved was particularly reprehensible. And so the court may confront that issue. This is also a case that provides the court with at least the possibility of applying their own principles of stare decisis again, because the B&W case was 5-4. The State Farm case was 6-3. The three in these cases basically say that the Due Process Clause puts no limits on punitive damages award. It's an interesting trio because it's Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, but it's also Justice Ginsburg. And all three basically feel like, loosely speaking, for either reasons of textual interpretation of the Due Process Clause or federalism principles, there's really not a role for the federal courts in superintending state damages awards as being excessive. Anything that has those three justices agreeing, and I would be quick to add, I mean, you know, when they dissented in the State Farm case, they made clear that not only did they disagree with Brown and Williams, BMW rather, against Gore, but they would continue to disagree. So I think you have three ready votes to get the court out of the business of superintending punitive damages awards. Anytime you have that trio thinking that, I don't think you can think that any judicial nominee of any party is going to obviously fall into one camp or the other on this issue. And so it's not out of the realm of possibilities that both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito would agree ultimately with Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Ginsburg that the federal court has no role here. It may be, though, in the end, based on the oral argument, that none of this really gets decided, because there did seem to be a lot of focus in the oral argument on the particular jury instruction in the case, what the jury instruction meant, and whether Philip Morris had preserved all its arguments. So this may be a case where it ends up going back to the state Supreme Court, and we may have, I may get to talk about it next year in my Supreme Court preview as well. A couple of other business cases I'll mention, a couple of antitrust cases on the court's docket. One involves a substantive issue of antitrust law. It involves a kind of interesting claim, which is basically a predatory buying claim. I think people are used to the claims about predatory pricing, where somebody's alleged to have priced artificially low in order to drive their competitors out of the market. This is really the flip side, where somebody is alleged to have paid excessively high prices for an input in order to basically drive its competitors out of business. The Supreme Court in the Brook Group case decided that there had to be fairly rigorous gatekeeping requirements before you could bring a predatory pricing claim. The question in this case is essentially, are there analogous requirements before you can bring this kind of predatory buying claim? The other issue in the antitrust docket before the court I would describe as more of a procedural issue than a pure substantive antitrust question. This is the Bell Atlantic against Twombly case. And it involves a very interesting issue about what do you do in a case where somebody is alleging parallel conduct that was the result of an unlawful agreement and restraint of trade. How much do you have to plead at the beginning of the case to get past the motion to dismiss stage? And one of the first things you learn in antitrust law, of course, is that parallel conduct, even consciously parallel conduct, in the absence of an agreement is not unlawful, and in fact, in many instances, can be a sign of a healthy and competitive economy. And so it makes it very easy, therefore, for a plaintiff in a case to allege lots of parallel conduct because, of course, there's lots of industries where there's lots of parallel conduct. And then the question is it enough to simply allege many, many instances of parallel conduct and then at the end of the complaint add, and we hereby allege an agreement and a conspiracy? And that's essentially, the plaintiff's counsel would certainly take a different view, but that's essentially the issue as it's presented to the court, and that's essentially what the complaint in the case did. I think it's pretty clear that that's what it did, at least as to one of the counts in the complaint. And so the court is dealing with this essentially pleading issue. You can think about it as being a Rule 8 or Rule 9 issue, but the substantive antitrust law here does play a role because the substantive antitrust law is so clear that the parallel conduct itself does not really advance the ball in terms of any allegation of unlawful conduct. And I think this is one context in which the procedural issue is ultimately probably going to be more important than the substantive issue, because these predatory buying claims are interesting. It's kind of fun to get your head around the flip side of predatory pricing, but that's going to be a relatively narrow set of cases that are affected. The pleading case is really something that I think will play a role in virtually every civil antitrust case, certainly every civil antitrust case under Section 1 in any event. So I think it's quite an important decision. At the risk of putting people to sleep after lunch, I will mention two patent cases on the court's docket. One involves, again, a procedural issue, which is whether or not somebody who's subject to a patent license, so they basically decided that they want to use a patented technology, can challenge the validity of the patent without breaking the license agreement. And the Federal Circuit said that basically they could not, that once they've entered into the license agreement, they've effectively settled the claim in advance. There's really no live case or controversy at that point. United States took the position that that was not the case, that just because you'd agreed to the license didn't mean that you couldn't litigate the validity of the patent claim. The substantive issue here, and I would say in these two patent cases, it's the reverse of the antitrust area. I think it's actually the substantive issue that's more important. This was a case argued this week involving the circumstances in which a patent is unique. The Federal Circuit has developed a fairly complicated test. Justice Scalia called it gobbledygook. That's his description, not the Federal Circuit's, obviously. It's called the Teaching Motivation and Suggestion Test. That's a pretty rigorous test for deciding whether or not there's something in the prior art that suggests a new innovation is sufficiently non-obvious or sufficiently obvious that it can go forward. The gist of the Federal Circuit's test is it makes it fairly difficult to defeat a patent claim on the grounds that the patent was not some great innovation, but was rather something that was obvious. I think it's fair to say, I mean, you can read some of the reports on the argument if you already haven't gotten more patent law than you'd like. I think the reports of the argument all sort of suggest that the Supreme Court was pretty skeptical of the Federal Circuit's test. It was also, I think, Justice Breyer had what has to be one of the best hypos of the term when he basically tried to analogize this case to an innovation of when he had his garage door opener. It was located low on the garage door, and he had raccoons and squirrels eating it and wrecking it. Would it be a patentable innovation to just simply move up the mechanics of the garage door opener to a higher point? Would that be patentable? I thought it was actually kind of captured the case, maybe perhaps better than even anything else in the case. I would say one thing about these business cases before I leave them, and that is to simply make the point that when the Chief Justice had his confirmations hearings, he mentioned something of an interest in maybe increasing the number of cases on the court's docket. So far, he really hasn't accomplished that objective. The court is, if anything, a little bit behind where it usually is in terms of the numbers of argued cases, the number of cases already on the docket. But there was also very much a suggestion, maybe not directly from the Chief Justice, but I think from a lot of commentators, that the Chief Justice, because he had been in private practice, done a lot of work for business clients, might be more receptive to adding cases to the court's docket in the area of the business docket. And I think that actually is borne out in the court's term. It is a relatively rich docket in terms of these business cases, important antitrust cases, important patent cases, important punitive damages cases. I know from my own perspective, having litigated on behalf of corporate defendants in private practice, there's really about three ways that a corporation can get itself in a lot of legal trouble. One's punitive damages, one's class actions, and the other one's treble damages. And I think it's maybe not a complete accident that the court has already, this term, basically dealt with two of those three issues, the punitive damages and the treble damages in the warehouse or the predatory buying claim. The criminal cases, obviously, always take up an important part of the court's docket. Let me briefly mention a couple of them. There are two kind of interesting cases that involve the extent to which constitutional violations can be brought on habeas, or whether those claims are barred because they are so-called Teague barred, or basically whether or not they simply, the interest in finality makes it no longer possible for somebody who was convicted under the old regime to get the benefit of the new rule. One of the things that's interesting about these cases, at least to me, is that two terms ago, the Supreme Court issued two, I think, by any measure, very important criminal procedure opinions, both loosely speaking in the Sixth Amendment area. One was the Blakely case involving sentencing. The other case was involved the Confrontation Clause, the Crawford case. And if you ask the question, how long does it take for the courts of appeals to become divided on the issue of whether a landmark criminal justice opinion is applicable on habeas? Apparently it takes two terms, because both of those cases are up in front of the court in the iteration of whether or not those claims, the Crawford Confrontation Clause claim or the Blakely sentencing claim, are available to defendants on habeas. And the court struggled with both of those issues in oral argument. I think they also are dealing with the issue that's of less importance to the federal government, frankly, of whether or not the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that was passed in 1996 somehow changes the analysis from the Teague case in these areas. I think what I'll leave you with on those two cases is simply the thought that the implication for either one of those cases, if the court were to find them retroactive on habeas and available to prisoners at this point in the day, would be quite significant as a practical matter, because sentencing issues are implicated in virtually every case in the states that were affected by the Blakely decision, and Confrontation Clause issues are implicated in a fair number of cases. So these aren't kind of esoteric issues that come up once in a blue moon. These are issues that come up in virtually every criminal case. Two other criminal cases that are of particular interest to me, I suppose, are the two cases the court recently granted involving the federal sentencing guidelines. The court, of course, in the Booker decision a couple of terms ago decided that the traditional mandatory guideline system that we'd lived with for 25 years was unconstitutional in its mandatory phase, but the court then, sort of an interesting flip of the opinion, said that it was constitutional as long as it was only advisory. One of the manifestations of that is that really it ushered in kind of a new era of sentencing appeals. It wasn't a long tradition in this country of having the ability of either the government, certainly the government, to appeal a criminal sentence. And generally, sentencing had been, even before the guidelines, sufficiently discretionary. There wasn't a lot to do with these sentencing appeals. In the wake of Booker, in order to try to deal with the notion that the guidelines are advisory, are supposed to have some bite, but are not supposed to be mandatory or dictate the results, a couple of circuits have come up with some rules to make the sentencing system work somewhat manageably. The Fourth Circuit, for example, decided that if the sentence is, in fact, within the advisory guidelines range, there's really no need for any rigorous review on appeal. It's, you know, all but per se reasonable. The Eighth Circuit had adopted a rule that basically says that if there's an extraordinary deviation from the guidelines range, then there needs to be an extraordinary justification for the extraordinary deviation. The Supreme Court has taken two cases that basically address whether or not those are valid approaches for sentencing. I think by at least certainly from the perspective of the federal government, these are incredibly important cases. You can measure importance in any number of ways, you know, the number of New York Times editorials it will generate. But for me, one clear indicator is just the practical effect. And there are 1,200 federal criminal sentencings each week in this country. And they tend to generate a fair number of appeals. And the standards that will govern on the appeals in all those 1,200 sentencings that take place each week are going to be governed by these two cases, the Claiborne case and the Rita case. So I think they are quite important in that regard. Let me just briefly mention a couple of cases that may be added to the Supreme Court's docket before the end of the term. The federal government has filed a petition that should be acted on in the next, it could be as soon as Monday, but if not, within the next couple of weeks, involving the issue of taxpayer standing. This is, you know, a great issue from both law school, but also has a lot of practical import as to how easy it is to bring Establishment Clause challenges. The traditional rule in this area is that, I mean, as a general matter, taxpayer standing is disfavored. The court in Flass v. Cohen, of course, created an exception for certain Establishment Clause cases when there was spending on a religious item authorized by Congress. The question that's posed in this case is effectively, do you have taxpayer standing to challenge executive branch action when it doesn't take the form of an actual sort of expenditure to a third-party religious group, but is basically an allegation that the federal government is spending too much of its time doing things that are favorable to religion or disfavorable to religion? So that's the issue in that case. I think if the court takes it, it'll be a closely watched and interesting case. Another case that may be added to the court's docket involves the interaction between the securities laws and the antitrust laws. The Second Circuit basically dealt with a case where there were allegations that in the process of underwriting a securities offering, there were antitrust violations. There's a consideration given that how much the SEC regulates the underwriting process, that maybe the underwriting process ought to be largely immune from antitrust scrutiny. The Second Circuit issued an opinion that suggested that was not the case. And so I think that's a case where, talking about the business docket, I mean, hard to imagine a more central case for the business docket in terms of a case that deals both with securities laws and antitrust laws, but also deals with the underwriting process and the market making, which is obviously a great engine of growth in our economy. The last case I'll mention is just the federal government also recently filed a petition in a case out of the 11th Circuit, where the 11th Circuit has struck down one of the provisions of the child pornography law. That was a law passed after the last Supreme Court case dealing with child pornography, the Ashcroft against Free Speech Coalition case. It was an effort by Congress to try to fix the statute. The 11th Circuit found that actions unavailing, and so the issue may be back before the Supreme Court, maybe as soon as the end of the of this term. It's, you know, since we just filed the petition, we could get it in this term, or it could spill over into the next term. I did want to leave a little time for questions, so with that, I'll do just that. I think Greg was going to help. What?
I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
On that patent case. Would you ask a question if you could just provide your name and your affiliation?
Chuck Eichen, Fish and Richardson,
I was wondering what you might expect the court to do in coming out with a new rule of patentability in the decision of that case. It appears clear that they're not going to accept the Federal Circuit rule as such, but what do you think may happen?
Well, it's a great question, and you know, I mean, I wish I knew the answer definitively. The one thing that I guess I would think is maybe the most likely is that the court may decide that it's not going to set forth a clear new rule. I mean, I think they may, in fact, think that what's happened here is that the statutory direction is one of focusing on obviousness, and I think, if anything, they may be reacting negatively to the fact that the Federal Circuit has established a rule that takes the focus away from the statutory factor of obviousness and focuses instead on teaching suggestion and motivation. I think that, therefore, I think the most natural tendency and probably the easiest thing to do would be for the court to say that the focus has to be more on the obviousness, and then, you know, they'll write the rest of the opinion and they'll provide some language that patent lawyers will spend the next 10 years poring over and litigating. But it's hard for me to predict what is going to be in the opinion. But, you know, you might point to the eBay case from last term as something of a model, where the court, you know, had a case where the Federal Circuit had started to develop a specific rule about when you have an injunction in the patent context. And what the court more or less did is say that, well, injunctions in the patent context are a lot like injunctions in other contexts. You have the familiar four-factor test, and go back and apply the four-factor test, not your gloss on the test. It doesn't provide a great deal of direction. You know, the eBay opinion, there were a couple of concurring opinions that started to provide some insights, at least as to how some justices approached the issue, and I wouldn't be surprised if you see something similar in the KSR case.
We also have a microphone to the side of the room if you'd like to use that. Any other questions?
It may be too soon to be asking this question, but what changes have you noted either in process or substance since the appointment of our two new justices to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's a great question, and, you know, I mean, obviously on a lot of levels it's too early to tell. But, you know, the dynamic at oral argument already is a bit different. You know, the Chief Justice Rehnquist had a very unique style. He had sort of this, you know, command over the courtroom that was really, you know, quite remarkable. I mean, I tell the story about having an argument where I was, you know, making what I thought was a clever argument, and he told me, you know, counsel, that's not within the question presented. And what are you going to do? You know, the Chief Justice has just told you it's not within the question presented. Or in another case, I was relying on one of the court's precedents from the 50s, and he said, counsel, that case is over 50 years old. And I was stunned because I was like, well, that's a bad thing? I mean, but when it came from the Chief Justice, you know, you sort of felt like there was something wrong with the Vincent Court or something. And Chief Justice Roberts, by contrast, still has incredible presence over the court, but I'd say it's kind of more, I mean, he asks, you know, very hard questions, but he doesn't have the tendency to sort of give an edict from the center of the bench the way Chief Justice Rehnquist would. And I would say that, you know, as an advocate before the court, it's great to have Chief Justice Roberts there because you can't miss the fact that he was a great Supreme Court advocate himself. And so you get the kind of questions that as an advocate you worry about. I mean, he tends to have the hardest question for both sides in the case because I think as an advocate that's what he was trained to think about. That's the way he would approach these cases. So he's very good at identifying kind of the weaknesses of the case. And I would say, I mean, I haven't tried to look at the numbers on this or anything, but my sense is he probably ends up asking a few more questions than Chief Justice Rehnquist would. Justice Alito, by contrast, has actually been kind of less active than I might have expected ex ante. And it may just be a matter of, you know, as a new associate justice, there's something of a tendency to kind of wait a little while to kind of warm up to the questioning process a little bit, although obviously, you know, he had lots of experience in the Third Circuit. I've gathered from talking to some of his clerks in the Third Circuit that he was, you know, a reasonably active judge in the Third Circuit, but not somebody who kind of, you know, dominated an oral argument the way that some Court of Appeals judges can on a panel. So I think, you know, it's kind of an interesting dynamic with him. It's kind of evolving. The questions he asks again are incredibly good questions. You know, he too was an alum of the Office of the Solicitor General, was a great appellate advocate himself. So I think the questions have sort of a shared commonality with the Chief Justice in that regard. And then obviously the fact that Justice O'Connor is no longer on the bench is also a big difference. You know, she was, in so many cases, was a decisive vote. You sort of knew that at the beginning of the argument. She was notorious for asking questions right out of the box. Almost, you know, more often than not, she asked the first question in a case. And, you know, when you had the chance to litigate in front of her, there were certain questions that she would ask when that you just knew you were about done with her. I mean, because, you know, a couple of times she asked me, you know, isn't it odd that, or isn't it strange? And, you know, and what would follow would basically be the position that I was trying to defend. And I knew right then that if it was odd or strange for Justice O'Connor, I probably wasn't getting her vote. So, you know, the dynamic of the argument has changed a great deal. But, you know, I think it's a little too early to tell where the court, how it's going to affect the court's dynamic more broadly. As I said, I think on stare decisis, there's a couple of cases that might provide us some insights already this term.
Sure. General, you mentioned the Crawford retroactivity cases, and I wanted to know what you thought about the continuing vitality, if any, of the Teague exceptions after AEDPA amended the habeas statute.
Well, I mean, I'll give you something of it may not be a very satisfactory answer because, you know, I mean, Teague won't go away no matter what happens because we in the federal government will still have to deal with Teague. And that's why we haven't really focused on the AEDPA issues because, you know, whatever the rule for AEDPA is, it's going to be very, very important for state prosecutors. It's just not going to matter for us. We're going to have to deal with it one way or another. And so, you know, we were asked at oral argument about some of the AEDPA provisions, and we provided, you know, the answer that I don't know that was entirely satisfying to all the justices, but, you know, I certainly think it's a fair one, which is just, you know, we haven't really sorted through that issue because it's not an issue that directly affects us. You know, I mean, one thing I'll just say by way of that's kind of an illustration of a broader point, which is when the federal government's not a party to a case, we, you know, often appear as an amicus. We appear in amicus in, you know, over half the cases that we're not a party. But when we make that judgment, we really make it based on the institutional interests of the federal government. And it's not some assessment about what's an important issue or an issue that's of significance for the overall, you know, justice system. I mean, the punitive damages case I mentioned is a perfect example. Obviously, for those in private practice, that's an awfully big issue. I know when I was in private practice, I wrote a lot of briefs involving punitive damages appeals. But the federal government did not participate in that case. We haven't traditionally participated in any of the line of punitive damages case. And the reason is simple. I mean, we are blissfully protected by sovereign immunity with respect to punitive damages in almost every context, so the issue really doesn't directly implicate our interest. I mean, another great example of that is the juvenile death penalty case from a couple of years ago. Huge case, very important Eighth Amendment case. Justice Kennedy's use of foreign law in the opinion sort of spawned 1,000 law review articles. By any measure, a very, very important case, but there's a federal statute that says that the federal government, you know, nobody's death penalty eligible unless they were 18 at the time of the offense. So no matter what the answer to the Eighth Amendment case, the federal government was going to be in the same position, so we stayed out of the case. Time for maybe one more question, if there is one. Or?
Well, I have one.
Okay, good.
You mentioned briefly some of the perspective that you use in deciding whether to become an amicus in a case or not. Could you explain a little bit further on that? And for instance, maybe provide context for cases in which you decide not to become involved in. For instance, I believe you said in Washington during the Federalist Society conference that you didn't take a position in the Connecticut eminent domain case.
Right. No, it's a great question. And, you know, as I say, I mean, every case we start with the same question, which is, you know, what's the interest of the United States being defined as the interest of the United States government and our sort of programmatic interests? And, you know, and these are decisions that, you know, and that corresponds actually to the first section of the brief, which is the statement of the interest of the amici. In all of these cases, we have to, you know, deal with that question at the beginning, and we often have to deal with it under pretty tight time constraints because, by definition, these are cases that involve private litigants that we haven't been following necessarily. And with the court's rules, if we're going to file a topside brief, we have 40 days to decide that that's what we're going to do. So when we get a case is granted by the court, we sort of kick into motion a process where we ask all the affected agencies about their views of the matter. We get a lot of information, gather where their interest lies. Some cases it's really easy. In the death penalty context, all you had to do was read the statute to realize that we didn't have an abiding interest. In other cases, like the federal preemption case I mentioned that was argued after the greenhouse gases case yesterday, there's a case where, even though we weren't a party, the basic issue in the case is the validity of a federal regulation. So, of course, we're going to get involved in the case, and, of course, we're going to get in on the side of defending the validity of the federal regulation. Some cases are a lot trickier. Kelo is a good example. I mean, when we were looking at the Kelo case, you know, there were a lot of people on both sides of that case very passionately interested in it. A lot of people would have been interested in us taking the side of the property owner. But as I said down in Washington, you know, at the end of the day, the federal government is a taker of property, not a takee. I mean, you know, there's no question what side that our institutional interests lie on the debate. So then the real hard question was whether or not we should participate in defense of the city of New London or whether we should just stay out of the case. And sometimes, you know, staying out of the case is the right answer because of the, you know, the interest of the United States is not squarely on the side that we think is the better of the argument or whatever it is. That was a case where we looked hard, and what we sort of, you know, discovered is that, you know, the federal government, although it takes property, really doesn't take property in contexts that implicate the issue in the Kelo case. We don't take it from one private individual, give it for another. We're not principally involved in sort of fostering economic development as such the way that states and localities are. You know, we take it to expand a national park or something, but that's, you know, more of the traditional use of the eminent domain authority that raises lots of interesting issues, which is why, you know, in a lot of cases we've been on the side of localities in takings cases, but really didn't raise the issue that was before the Supreme Court in that case, so we decided to stay out of that case. The last thing I'll say is just in some cases the hardest cases to decide what to do are those where you identify not one federal interest but two, and they point in different directions. Great example is the federal employment cases where, you know, generally you have something like the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, there's the Rehabilitation Act, which imposes the same obligations on the federal government. The Civil Division spends a lot of their time defending the federal government against claims that they violated the Rehabilitation Act. So when the court grants an ADA case, the Civil Division thinks, yes, there's an interest of the United States. It's to defend the employer in the case because we're the nation's largest employer. We have a strong interest in it. At the same time, though, the Civil Rights Division down the hall has enforcement responsibilities for the ADA. And so all things being equal, they're likely to say, sure, we have an interest in this case. It's on the employee's side of the case. And we get to, you know, the not so easy and sometimes delicate task of trying to reconcile those issues and interests. Sometimes there's a way we can at least try to have our cake and eat it too, say that, you know, in the private sector the rule is slightly different or something, and, you know, but in some cases we effectively have to choose where the, you know, predominating interests of the federal government are, and that's about one of the more difficult tasks we have.